In our gospel reading this morning, we join the story of Jesus and his disciples at a very crucial moment. The journey that Jesus had been travelling on with his followers is coming towards its climax. And you can feel the tension building in the way that Mark tells the story. Jesus is now way ahead of his disciples and the rest of the crowd. He's a way ahead of them both literally and metaphorically, striding out towards Jerusalem and towards that agonizing future that he knows awaits him there, while his disciples struggle to keep up with him, again, both literally and metaphorically, because the disciples don't actually have a clue about what's really going on. What they do know is that the grand finale is about to be played out. Jesus himself is so focused and so determined that, Mark tells us, the disciples are astonished. Meanwhile, the rest of the crowd are afraid. Everyone knows that the moment of truth is approaching, and everyone knows that Jerusalem is the place where it will all unfold. It's just that they all have very different ideas as to what this truth is going to be when the moment comes. The disciples and the crowds who follow on behind still have the notion that they're all taking part in some kind of victory procession, that the new age of the kingdom of God is about to arrive. They reckon that this will be the moment when all the enemies of God and all the enemies of God's people will be destroyed. The moment when Jesus, the Messiah King, will be installed as the ruler of all. Of course, that is not how Jesus himself sees it. Not that Jesus hasn't tried to explain it to his disciples. We're told this is the third time that Jesus has spelled out clearly and simply and in detail to his disciples, not to the crowd, just to his disciples, exactly what lay ahead of them in Jerusalem. He spells it out as plainly as could be. And each time he gives more and more detail so that by this time they really ought to know what lies ahead. And they ought to know that Jesus is serious about it. But of course, human nature being what it is, people tend to hear what they want to hear and ignore or reinterpret or dismiss as exaggeration or even pretend they haven't heard what they'd rather not hear. Perhaps the disciples didn't really want to take in what Jesus was saying about a way of suffering, a way of the cross, a way of sacrifice, about Jesus joining that long line of godly prophets in their history who had come to a sticky end in Jerusalem. That couldn't possibly be like that for Jesus. In a sense, as they got nearer to Jerusalem, what the disciples started doing was to turn in upon themselves, as if forming into a circle that was more and more inward-looking and self-absorbed. And in particular, their focus seemed to be entirely on what they were going to get out of it all. What would be the reward of their loyalty? What positions would each of them get in the new government? Given that they were the first people to join in the movement, this Jesus movement, the first to join up, what special privileges would be theirs when the moment of victory arrived? And James and John are the particular ones this time who revealed just how little the disciples understood at this point. Though to be honest, they're all the same. But it's the two brothers who come up to Jesus and ask him to do them a favour, a kind of quid pro quo. In Matthew's version of the story, it's actually their mother who speaks to Jesus on their behalf, but it doesn't really matter. The point is the same. James and John want to be considered for the top jobs in the cabinet. Eventually, Jesus tells them it's not up to him to make that kind of decision. God, the Father, will give those places to whom he has chosen. But before that, Jesus makes, first of all, a comment and then asks them a two-part question. The comment is simply, you just don't know what you're asking for. And then the question, can you drink the cup that I must drink? Can you be baptized in the way I must be baptized? And their immediate response is, yes, we can. Of course we can. Yes, absolutely. You bet. But it was quite obvious to Jesus then, and just as obvious to us 2,000 years on, that they didn't really understand what Jesus was saying, or what they were saying yes to. Or perhaps, again, they just didn't want to believe that what Jesus was actually saying would happen. The bottom line is, James and John were simply looking for some kind of reward for being followers. They seemed to think that they deserved one, and that they had a right to ask it of Jesus. Now, before we mentally wag our fingers and shake our heads at these two disciples, who ought to have known better, maybe we should pause to reflect on the way we ourselves sometimes think. Let's be honest. Do we not sometimes entertain in our minds the notion that God must surely look after those who believe in him a bit more than he looks after those who ignore him, or deny him, or even defy him? In other words, when you've nailed your colours to God's mast, do you not deserve a little bit of special consideration or favour from him? A little bit of special treatment, or at the very least, some sort of immunity from disaster? Isn't that why we struggle with the fact that bad things do happen to apparently good people? Surely people who've made the right choice ought to be rewarded. And that's all that James and John were looking for. Jesus, we've been with you from the start. That must count for something, surely. But they had no idea what they were actually asking. Can you drink the cup I have to drink? Asked Jesus. So how could the disciples have misunderstood Jesus when he spoke about this cup? Well, maybe a little bit of background information will help. In biblical times, it was the custom at a royal banquet for the king to hand his cup to his guests to be passed around. It was a privilege to share in the king's cup. And so the cup became a kind of figure of speech for the life and the experiences that God, as king of the universe, handed out to human beings. And that's the way the phrase is used throughout the Bible. The cup might contain joy or sorrow, life or death, reward or punishment. And normally in the Old Testament, the rewards go to the people of God and the punishment goes to the enemies of God. But it was whatever God poured out for you. Think of that 23rd Psalm, for example, that we heard again this morning. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. Overflows with good things is the implication. And maybe that's the picture that came into the minds of James and John at this point when Jesus asked them if they could drink the cup that he must drink. That Jesus was talking about a cup like the one in the psalm, a cup of celebration served in the presence of enemies who'd just been defeated. You bet, Jesus, we want to join with you in that. Perhaps James and John just couldn't imagine, could not believe for a moment that the cup that was about to be handed to Jesus might actually be a cup of suffering. They couldn't imagine this, even though Jesus had spelled it out in great detail exactly what was about to happen. From our perspective, looking back on the whole story, we know that it was exactly this, that it was a cup of suffering. It's underlined for us as the story unfolds in the next chapters of the Gospels. For example, at the Last Supper, when Jesus meets with his disciples and Jesus literally passes around the cup, saying, "This is my lifeblood, which is poured out for many, my blood that seals God's covenant." And later, as Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane prays, as we were singing about, prays to his heavenly Father, saying explicitly, "Father, take this cup of suffering away from me, yet not what I want, but what you want." So looking back, we can see quite clearly that what Jesus was saying to his followers, that It was going to be a cup of suffering, not celebration. That Jesus knew what lay ahead of him, and he was asking his disciples simply, can you travel this road that I must travel? Because it's a road that leads through persecution and suffering. Can you come with me along this road that leads to a baptism? Baptism. There's another word that could be understood in more ways than one. It meant literally to be submerged, to go down under, like a ship being wrecked and sinking beneath the waves. But again, what Jesus was clearly talking about was his death, though once more that may not have been quite as clear to the disciples as it is to us. Because you see, the whole concept, the very idea of a suffering servant Messiah, as foreseen by the prophet Isaiah, was probably something quite alien to them, even though it was part of their holy scriptures. They would have known those passages in Isaiah that we so clearly associate with Jesus. But at the time, people did not associate those verses in Isaiah with the Messiah. They assumed that Isaiah was talking about the people of Israel suffering, not about the Messiah. That's not how folk were thinking in these days at all. The traditional Jewish expectation was that on the day of the Lord, the great day of the Lord, at God's chosen moment, the Messiah was going to arrive in glory and in power, judging everyone and ruling all, dishing out rewards to the righteous and punishment to the unrighteous. And those who had remained loyal and righteous in the eyes of the Messiah could expect to receive some recognition for their faithfulness, some sort of reward. A great and powerful Messiah surrounded by his great and distinguished disciples. That was the vision that James and John were nurturing. Possibly had nurtured all their lives. Certainly were now. Their whole world view, their way of thinking, had no room in it for ideas of humble service or humiliating suffering. And least of all, of horrific self-sacrifice. The idea of a suffering Messiah, a persecuted Messiah, a crucified Messiah, that was unthinkable. It just wasn't part of their worldview, nor was it part of their way of thinking that this was the road that they would have to travel as followers of the Messiah. They thought they were on the path to celebration and glory. Now again, before we criticise the disciples for being so thick and so slow in the uptake and failing to hear what Jesus was clearly teaching them, perhaps we have to ask ourselves, how much is it part of our way of thinking as modern day disciples that this is the journey that we're on? Because it seems to me that sacrifice doesn't appear to be very much part of our vocabulary either. We tend to have, as someone once put it, an insatiable appetite for our own comfort. An insatiable appetite for our own comfort. It's part of our human nature, I suppose. But what makes it especially relevant for us today is that this is also the dominant way of thinking in all of our still affluent Western society. The idea of making any kind of sacrifices for anything has become pretty unusual, to say the least. Oh, people will make sacrifices to pursue their own goals, their ambitions for fame, for wealth, or success, or whatever. But truly selfless sacrifices on behalf of others, these are much less common. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, just that it's not the norm. Even giving to charity often has to have some sort of reward associated with it, the reward of recognition. But the willingness to take on the uncomfortable and the unappreciated and the unrewarded or even the costly option doesn't come easily or naturally to us. I include myself in this. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, just that it's not the spirit of our age nor even of the church. Perhaps most of us, most of the time, are pretty much like James and John, in that we want the crown without the cross. We want the glory without the loss. We want the new life without the putting to death of the old life. In fact, we want, above all, an easy way, a comfortable way, a way with all the bumps and potholes and rough places smoothed out. And instead, Jesus invites us to come along with him on a hard road, a road that leads to a cross. What Christ is looking for now, as he was looking for then, are people who are prepared to be authentic disciples. People who will walk in his way, even if that is a way that leads to a cross. Real disciples, he says, are cross bearers and humble servants. People willing to drink the cup and go through with the baptism. Disciples seek and follow Christ wherever he leads. Now that is an enormous challenge to us, is it not? Sometimes I wonder if maybe we should just ban words like church member. Because they give the impression that what the church is about is the creation of some kind of club that exists for the benefit of its members, and that when you join it, you get certain privileges because you're part of it, as well as perhaps some responsibilities. But Christ is looking for disciples, not members. People who will follow him on the road, not cheer him from the sidelines. Can you drink the cup I must drink? It's still one of the most important and disturbing questions Jesus asks. His message of servitude, of suffering, even of slavery and death for the sake of others, was a very different circle for the disciples to try to wrap their minds around. It needed a complete change in their way of thinking, which happened, but also in our way of thinking. Jesus preached that it was only through helping and saving others, only by focusing on the powerless, the hopeless, and the insignificant, that a disciple could be rightly called great. The one who was a servant. A truly great disciple would be someone who was just like Jesus himself. In other words, someone who might suspect that he would be let down by his friends, but would go on loving them anyway. Someone who might expect to be deceived by his enemies, but would go on loving them anyway. Someone who would be willing to suffer persecution if that's what it took, while knowing deep down that the only reward for your faithfulness and obedience might be the cost of even losing your own life for your friends. Can you drink the cup I must drink? Well, could we? Could we really drink that cup? It's so much easier to circle the wagons and turn inwards upon ourselves than it is to reach out to others. So much easier and safer to focus on our own needs and wants than to face outwards in a world that might just make fun of us, or reject us, maybe hurt us, or even, in extreme cases, try to destroy us. Can you drink the cup I must drink, he asks. My answer is, I don't know, Lord. But I know that it is the only cup that gives life. Can you be baptized with the baptism I must endure? I don't know, Lord. But I know that sacrifice is the sacrament of love. And that you loved me enough to pay the price. There are many of our sisters and brothers around the world who do have to pay that price. At the very least, and it is the very least we can do, we can reach out to them in solidarity and compassion. We can pray for them, not just on one Sunday of the year, but constantly. We can speak up for them whenever the opportunity arises, whatever the cost to ourselves or our own popularity. We can reach out, because they are our sisters and our brothers. St. Ignatius of Loyola summed it up perfectly in his famous prayer. Let it be our prayer. Lord, teach me to be generous. Teach me to serve you as you deserve, to give and not to count the cost, to fight and not to heed the wounds, to toil and not to seek for rest, to labour and not to ask for reward, except to know that I am doing your will.